All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michael Witte from ONC. I'm the acting designated federal official today. And welcome to the intersection of clinical and administrative or data or IPAD task force. We'll be officially calling the meeting to order now. Start with roll call. Do we have, Cheryl, you're here.
Yes.
And Alex is here. Aaron, Mary, are you here? Okay. Abby Sears? Alexis Snyder?
Here.
Okay, hi. Andy Truscott? Okay, Anil Jain?
I'm here.
So, Aaron Malik?
I'm here.
Great. Deborah Strickland? Hey, Denise Webb?
I'm present.
Great. Jessica Rossi?
I'm here.
Hello. Jackie Monson?
Here.
Great. Jim Georges?
I'm here.
Great. Hello. Justin Keegan?
I'm here.
Hello. Les Leonard? Okay. Mary Green?
This is Alex Muggy here for Mary Green.
Oh, hey, Alex. Ram Sriram? Rich Landon?
I'm here.
Hello. Sasha Termat?
Hello.
Hello. Steve Brown? Tom Mason?
I'm here.
Hello. And Carolyn Peterson? Okay. Anybody I missed? All right. Well, then, thanks to everybody for joining and to the members of the public who are also here with us. And I'm going to turn it over to the co-chairs to begin this meeting agenda. Alex Goss and Cheryl Turney, please take it away.
Well, thank you so very much, Michael, and for stepping in on behalf of Lauren today. Welcome, everyone, to our pseudo Monday. It's Tuesday afternoon, and it's time for ICAD. We're going to be reviewing or picking up where we left off on the Ideal State Guiding Principle work group update to continue reviewing the document that we started last week. We'll then pivot over to data classes update from Josh and Cheryl, talk about a draft timeline discussion today, which I think will be pretty critical to get some feedback on that. So Cheryl and I look forward to walking you through that before going into next steps and, of course, ensuring that we have time for public comment later today. So if we could go ahead and go to the next, in one more slide, what we thought would be good is to start out with our usual sort of context setting. This one's a little bit more far-reaching than just the last week. We thought it would be just kind of good to kind of put our arms around the level of work that we've been pursuing since the beginning of March in producing and updating a compendium of historical artifacts, which I think is really foundational to the launch-off point for our vision and charge of addressing the various aspects of prior authorization, the larger conversation of the convergence of clinical administrative data. Along the way, we started out with some discussions about use cases and workflow diagrams and really took a deep dive in examining the wheelchair order process for prior authorization. We've had a variety of small groups doing offline work between our weekly calls around the data classes and categories in alignment with USCDI. We've been looking at ideal state and guiding principles for our work. That is all captured in our Google Sheet spreadsheet. Last week, actually, we kicked off the privacy and security small group, That is a group that's going to take the ideal state and guiding principles more globally that we've been addressing for prior authorization and take a very focused look around privacy and security. And I'm happy to report that group hit the ground running pretty hard last week, thanks to the support of Jackie Munson and the others that joined the call, Rom and Sasha and Denise. We've also had a number of presentations over the last 6 weeks, including those from SureScripts, CoverMyMeds, Humana, Cambia, and the American Medical Association, and are currently working on scheduling some additional ones, thanks to the industry level of expression in coming to present to us. We also have provided an update to HITACH on our progress, as we reported out at last week's call. That paints a picture of sort of the trajectory so far, and we've made a lot of progress, and I'm hoping that with today's work, we can wrap up a few things related to guiding principles and future state, whereas we're looking for some initial feedback on our first summation work. And then also, after we hear from Josh and Cheryl, I'm thinking the timeline conversation will help us all start to refocus ourselves on the work ahead for the summer. With that sort of context setting, Cheryl, any additional thoughts or comments?
No, I think you did a great job. Thanks, Al.
You're welcome. Okay, what I'd like to do is ask Excel to now start presenting the screen share that I've offered. Hopefully they'll all see the guiding principles and future state document. Okay, so can someone give me a visual clue that you can actually see the Word document?
Yes, we can see it.
Auditory clue. Thank you. All right, so at last week's call, we started to look at the this document. I have updated it to reflect check marks on the items that we actually talked about and also captured that we've kind of punted on security and privacy pending the small work group output. So that means that we're going to pick up with the last three categories today. First, before I start doing that, are there any general questions from folks on what the overview I've just done or on the guiding principles in future state?
I'm not seeing any hands raised, Alex.
Thank you so very much for that. Okay. All right, so we will be picking up with designs for the future while solving the needs of today. So I'm just going to walk through these and look for Cheryl to stop me so when we've got questions, we can take those in today's discussion. Perfection in every scenario is not possible. Let's go for great enough, covering the vast of the majority of the cases. You know, some might think of this as the 80-20 rule, but we really want to make a difference not only in prior authorization, but in the larger convergence conversation, but we're not going to let perfection be the enemy of the good by going for the majority of the cases. Our approach should be sensitive to clinician burden to drive adoption and obtain desired results. If a floor is established meeting related to the standards, no longer a ceiling, ensure corresponding operating rules and regulatory rules allow for rapid standards development and evolution so as to not preclude innovation. The operating rules should continue to raise the foundational level of adoption while encouraging, supporting organizations raising the ceiling capabilities. Those are the four aspects of design for the future.
Questions? So, Alex, we do have a question. If now's a good time to stop. Richard,
please.
Do you have a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, it's Rich Flandin. Question number one. I'm concerned with the quantification of vast majority of the cases. This is a pretty immense field, and I'm not sure that trying to do the vast majority is attainable. I'd like to suggest we limit that language. to something more manageable? I mean, I agree with the concept. We don't want to boil the ocean. We want to be pragmatic and grow future, but I don't want to set sights too high, which would preclude us from targeting use cases that are limited in quantity but high in value. Am I making my concern clear?
Yeah, so are you thinking that covering the vast majority of cases is should go and that we should revamp it with...
Yeah, vast majority specifically is my concern, because to me that's talking like 80% of all prior auth, and that's just way too much. So I'd choose language something like that somehow employs the term significant.
Yeah, why is 80% way too much?
Hey, Arian.
Hey.
Welcome.
I think from the discussions and presentations we've had, there's prior auth and there's prior auth. There's some simple stuff that's, I think, attainable, but there are a lot of situations where it's either too complex or, like ordering a wheelchair for discharge after surgery, it's too iterative for the first attempt. So if we can get 80%, that's great. But my concern is we need to be a little bit more focused where we start.
Arian, did you have any thoughts on that? Because I heard you speak up there,
yeah,
and I think
no,
I see Alexis. So
I would be an advocate for setting our sights high and then downgrading in a phased approach. If we set our sights towards automating a small set of cases, then that may be achievable but not meaningful. And what we're trying to find is the meaningful portion here. And you know, a lot of these things are, do we think that 80% is unachievable ever, or is this a time frame question? So the other way to address this is to say, do we agree on, and you know, 80%, 95%, do we agree that that is the target, and then we have a time frame that we are seeking to achieve, or do we not believe that that should be a target at all? I guess would be the other way I'd frame my counter concern. So my counter concern is setting our sights low and achieving it versus, you know, I'd rather set our sights high and fall short of the mark than set our sights low and achieve it.
So this is Alex, and so I want to do just a little housekeeping for all of us to remember to say our names first. The other thing is from a housekeeping perspective, Cheryl, I have figured out how with two monitors to be able to still see the hands raised. So I've now got that ability to view that, so thank you. I see that Alexis next in the queue, and then Anil.
And can we remind people to please raise your hand, and when we're done with the hand-raising feature, we'll call for people on the phone that we can't see who are not in the live stream. Thanks.
Thank you for remembering that. So hands raised, Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, real quick, I agree with Arian. He pretty much made my point already. I mean, I just would say real quick that, you know, if we're making recommendations as a task force for what is supposed to be obtainable for all in the end, you know, I really don't think we should be using, you know, language like that and be trying to aim with what works for, you know, either like we talked about before, what works for most difficult first may trickle down into everything else getting done for what's easiest, or vice versa, as you know, maybe stating something more like we're going to work with simple first as a place to start. But yeah, I just don't think that we want to start talking about, you know, we're going to help some and not all and really put a figure on that to be more meaningful.
Thank you, Alexis. Neil?
Yeah, no, I think I would tend to agree. I think the goal here would be that if we were trying to find something that's more quantitative than qualitative, that's going to be very difficult to do for all the reasons that were discussed. So given what section this is in, I would recommend finding some general language that supports the intent of what we just discussed and moving on. Otherwise, we could get into a very much a semantics issue that could derail us from getting through all the other points that we need to cover. But the general, I think we all generally agree with all the comments, is how do we convert something that we would all want to be able to quantify and say, you know, a certain percentage of meaningful PAs would be done in this way. I just think that the language of, let's just say that it's going to be a majority of those that should be covered by these guidelines. Because we're not going to get to every single scenario, and I don't think there's any point in trying to quantify something that, as we've discovered, is quite complicated and difficult to quantify in any significant way.
Got it. Okay, so I'm not seeing any other hands up. I'm going to keep moving to solicit to see if there are any other feedback on Rich. Hopefully you're still okay with all that feedback. And what I did as the takeaway is that we need to tweak that sentence, and we can do that wordsmithing offline with everyone to have another bite at the apple downstream. Are there any other comments either on number one or more especially on 2, 3, or 4?
It looks like Jocelyn has her hands raised.
She's not bubbling to the top.
Yeah.
That has a...
I'm using the app on my phone today, and it's not working really well. So, only additive thing I would say is I think that there's complexity around the types of prior auths that are done. And I think that there is this, and I completely agree with all the comments, this desire to say for the things that fit into the 80% bucket, which are the ones that are codifiable or sort of single-use prior auths between two parties, that we should set the bar to be able to automate those, right, and to reduce the burden of those as much as possible. But there is this reality that there are more complex sort of episodic multi-party prior authorizations that require data from multiple sources, that we should create a path forward to automating, building on what we do to sort of streamline and reduce the burden of the more simplistic one, if that makes sense. And I don't know if simple and complex is the way to phrase it, but I feel like having exemplars to say, if you can do this one, you can then do these 5 other kinds. And then if you have this more complex, an exemplar of that, and you can solve for that, then the system can learn, right, how to tackle the more complex ones.
Okay.
And that was a lot
episodic
more
multi
sentence, so.
No, I think I get it. But the episodic multifaceted prior auth versus the less complex scenarios sort of aspect needs to be factored in here, and that makes a lot of sense to me. So I think I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a check mark for Rich.
I was going to say, I think there's prior auths that we do that get approved ultimately at rates of 98%, 99% by payers. Let's figure out how to automate those guys, because that takes a huge amount of waste out of the system. But then there are ones that require sort of the journey of the patient and more information to get exposed as you know more about what needs to be done for those patients. And we should strive towards that. But I think that we're probably in round one not going to figure out how to fully automate those, but we can definitely figure out how to reduce burden on them by the tools we'd use on the more simplistic ones.
Okay. Got it. So am I inferring you're on audio but not on visual, or are you on both, Jocelyn?
I've wandered my way back to my laptop because apparently using my phone alone wasn't working.
All righty. Thank you for that. All right. Any call for other questions or comments, discussion on design for the future, 4 bullets?
I don't see anyone else with their hand raised, Alex.
Oh, did Alexis just pop up as you were saying that?
I don't want to take up any more time. I typed it into the chat box because I forgot to mention the wording for burden under number 2. So just wanted to point that out.
Okay. So we are going to want to be more encompassing than clinician, so we can modify our sensitivity level. Thank you for that clarification. Anybody else?
Alex, this is Cheryl. On that number two, I think just to reflect the comment that was made last week was that we just need to be also sensitive that any recommendations that we make don't inadvertently add to the burden. And I'm not going to say physician burden, but really all over burden, because that was one of the examples that someone made. I didn't capture who it was, but it provided actually a really good example of something that appeared to be helpful, but if you look at the long side of it, could then result in significant burden, not only for the physician, but also for the patient.
So be mindful of unintended burden consequences from our recommendations. I think that seems to be a good principle at the, you know, overall, but I'll capture it here. So thank you for bringing that up, Cheryl. Okay, I'm not seeing any hands raised, so gonna move on. Final call. Okay, so let's talk about aligned and national standards. Accelerate industry adoption of national electronic standards for prior auth and improve ongoing transparency of formulary information and coverage restrictions at the point of care and during duration of episode. Our work should inform the coordination and alignment of existing efforts rather than reinvent. Standardized data will align with USCDI and will be the basis of data exchange for prior auth. And that if it is not in USCDI, then ICAD Task Force will prioritize feedback for consideration in subsequent versions. Standard format and related policy adopted at a national level for additional documentation, request and response, to provide supplemental information needed to process the prior auth request, AKA we'll have attachment regulations. So this is, there is an attachment standard with broad ability for payers to receive provider attachment submissions. And without an attachment standard, their clarity will exist on the rules for how providers supply additional information to payers to avoid denials of prior auth because of a lack of information capable of being sent in an initial prior auth request. I'm going to stop with those four and see if there are any questions, comments. Jocelyn.
I don't know the exact language up at the beginning on number one, but I think there's something between formulary information and coverage restrictions that formulary and benefits does more than just tell you what's on formulary. It tells you what the recommended treatment is for that particular plan. So I don't know if it's as simple as just adding formulary and benefits, or not making it just coverage restrictions, but coverage recommendations and restrictions. I feel like there's something there that somebody that's more on the PBM side might have a bigger opinion about than I do, but I just know that it's a heck of a lot more than just formulary.
I've made a few additions. I'm going to move on to Rich Landon.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. On number two, I think there's besides the coordination and alignment of existing efforts, I think there's another dimension that might prove valuable for this task force to help out those initiatives, and that is working with those initiatives to understand the barriers that they're running into when they're trying to find their solutions and to see if there's anything we can do at our level to remove or get around those barriers. So it's not just bringing the groups together and talking about what they're doing and sharing and trying to get them all pulling in the same direction. It's seeing what walls they're running into and what can we do about those walls that those groups don't have the power to do by themselves.
Okay, sorry, I captured a note there, Rich. I'm hoping that's...
That's got the sense of it, yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. Denise.
Hi, this is Denise. Just a comment on number three.
I love it.
We formed, High Tech formed the USCDI Task Force to, we had a charge to respond to making recommendations relative to the proposed rule. So maybe some of my fellow task force, fellow committee members can weigh in here, but I'm not sure that the task force is a standing task force and that the idea was, that task force had made recommendations about the process for updating the USCDI and how stakeholders could introduce new elements and so forth and what the periodicity of the updates would be. So I think it's more a process that's going to be managed by ONC now. But I welcome my fellow committee members to weigh in, but that's what I recall. Just want to make sure we assign this to the right place.
Denise, this is Cheryl. I think you're right. I think it should be assigned to ONC versus the USCDI Task Force.
Okay. Thank you very much for catching that, Denise. Jocelyn? Up and down. Okay. Okay. Other comments on 1 through 4? Okay. So let's talk about number 5. There would be consistent standards advancement process used for administrative and clinical standards adoption. New standards have low additional development and implementation costs relative to the benefits of using the standard. Standards, implementation guides, and operating rules are freely available, and the development activities are funded through private and public sector investments and initiatives. Jocelyn. I see your hand up, but I'm not hearing you.
Talking on mute, sorry. Can you unpack what number 5 says? I just don't know. Maybe what a little bit of background on what the point is that it's trying to make.
Happy to do so. So currently today, we have a method for updating HIPAA transactions and in particular ICD code set that require vetting through the designated standards maintenance organizations or DSMOs to NCVHS. It produces recommendations to go to the feds, the secretary, ultimately to the Division of National Standard, who eventually will produce a notice of proposed rulemaking that we'll all respond to, and eventually we'll get a final rule. When we look at the standards advancements process that has recently been promulgated under ONC's interoperability rule, we have a new standards versions advancements process, or affectionately acronymized as SFAP, which enables us to have, through a formal rulemaking process, a base standard incorporated by reference. Through formal rulemaking of the NPRM and final rule processes, that process is run also in HHS, but within the ONC side of the house. Once the feds adopt that base version, then we can incorporate updates new versions of that already promulgated and incorporated by reference standard. So we have different processes for how somebody gets an upgrade to our administrative and our clinical standards. It would be nice for the industry if we could have a consistent process on how to manage those. That's my two cents. I would ask Arian, Anil, or Alexis, or Tom to weigh in on that. And it looks like Arian's hand is already up.
Awesome. So first of all, that was very masterful. A round of applause for that encyclopedic knowledge. The other thing I'd add to it is that what we did around API transactions with the Argonaut project and ONC rulemaking assistance is created intentional room for innovation and standards advancement in advance of formal rulemaking. And so we put in place a process that allows the floor and ceiling approach. We put in place a process that allows the floor to advance at a common level for everybody, but without creating inadvertent disincentives for people to use a new method that raises the ceiling. Right now, with HIPAA transaction standards, you were sort of on paper out of compliance if you adopted, for example, a Firebase transaction end-to-end. Without going through a 278 or other adopted HIPAA transaction. So there's two pieces to this. One is making sure that we have a common standards advancement process across CMS and ONC. Second is making sure that we have a more flexible standards advancement process. And third is making sure that we have a standards advancement process that is that allows for raising the floor and raising the ceiling all at the same time, as opposed to sort of merely raising the floor and ceiling in lockstep. And then, you know, I guess the last piece is right now HL7 has moved to making Firebase-based standards freely available, but with a benefit for being a Fire or being an HL7 member. And their business model didn't go away. There's been an ongoing debate over whether selling IP and making standards available only to licensees is the right way to fund a standards development organization. There's models on both sides, but I think from an innovation perspective, it's pretty clear that the standards implementation guidance freely available, but membership required to participate in the process. Is the approach that drives the greatest adoption and innovation around standards.
Thank you. I think you were maybe touching a little bit upon number 5, but also number 6.
Correct.
Okay, so thank you. I'm not sure if I was supposed to capture something around number 6 or if it was more providing additional color,
exactly. That was just providing color commentary around those points.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so very much. Jocelyn.
So I was just going to add, so I think that there's a lot packed into 5 that those of us that are living and breathing this stuff really understand the difference for, but if we're writing this for others to read and absorb sort of the full impact of that, I think it would be worth calling out sort of that there are two distinct processes that behave differently, and I do think that, and I don't know if it goes with 5 or 6, I do think this concept of allowing for innovation and flexibility I think is incredibly important to get across.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Rich, Landon?
Yeah, I think Alex, you and Arian did a great job. There's one point that I'd like to make for the information of the task force, although I don't think it needs to be added to the language, presuming we're going to do some unpacking as was just suggested. But that's that the administrative transactions under HIPAA, part of that process does allow for exceptions. So if a group wants to use something that is not a standard, they have to make application to the Secretary of HHS. There's a whole process for that. It's a little murky on how user-friendly that is. Essentially, it has not been used very often, but that is available, and that is something that we need to keep, I think we should keep in the back of our minds in case we run into something that in the short term needs to happen before this conversation we just had about aligning the two different paths for standards adoption in DNS and ONC gets completed. Thanks.
Good catch. I forgot about the exception process. How could I forget about 162.940? Okay. So I see no other hands raised on this. So I think time check, Cheryl, since I can't see the agenda, do I have time to still go to the last category?
Yes. Yes, you do.
Thank you. All right. So the last one, prior authorization processes necessitate a point person to ensure the prior auth is fully resolved, quarterback role, in other words, and related coordination slash follow through is performed. One of the things that we've heard before, to give a little bit of color commentary, is that there have been some discussions around we want to try to be that point of care between the provider and the patient. We understand that that's not always realistic, that it's often prior authorization ends up being centralized within provider offices, and that ultimately it's going to take a point person to make sure the whole process is completed from start to end and renewals included. So we felt like it was important to call out that there was this need for a point person. Taking questions, comments, observations on this uncategorized bullet. Okay, not hearing any. I think people agree as far as a guiding principle or ideal state. I'm not sure which one it falls into yet, but I think at this point now we've walked this complete document, capture, and I'll take this back with the team, and we will continue to do our work on it. And I think at this point, I'm all good to go. I think I'm ready to turn over you, Cheryl, and Josh, and I'm not sure I'll stop sharing.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks, Alex. Josh is going to share the screen and provide an update on the data classes work group. And I see Josh has already got a preview up there, so. And I'll let Josh go in. In our last meeting, if you'll recall, we indicated it would be helpful to have definitions or a description for each of the data classes, and I see that they did update those. So, Josh, why don't you go ahead and take that away?
Yep. Thanks, Cheryl. Can everybody see my screen okay?
Yes, we can see it.
All right. So, to Cheryl's point, yeah, our major accomplishment over the last week was just going through and adding some context to each of the data classes that we've been discussing as a group for some time now. I think we've discussed these in terms of data elements that would be useful in the prior auth context. We've also rolled those up to this data class level for ease of reference and discussion points. So one of the things that I think the group was kind of making the point last time we met was that, you know, it gets a little difficult sometimes. We may lose some things in translation when we start talking about these things at a higher level. So the notion of adding a description to each of the data classes was proposed, and I think it's a good one to help make sure we're all speaking the same language. So I'll walk through these at a high level. Obviously, they're out there for everyone's detailed reference if you want to go out and take a closer look. Some of these are a little more straightforward than others, so I'll try to focus my comments on some of those that I think are a little more ambiguous at face value. So starting from the top and working our way down, I'm going to Let's skip the patient identity one for a second and come back to that at the end. But the first one I wanted to touch on was patient demographics. Again, this is one of the more straightforward discussion points, so not to belabor it, but we did just want to clarify that the demographic information we were talking about are things that would be in alignment with the patient demographics described in the version one of the USCDI data model. So that is out there for reference. Getting into more of the nitty-gritty related to prior auth, we have a data class around insurance plan information. So the take-home here is that this would be information collected by a provider at the time that a patient presents in a facility or clinic, but about the payer that they are covered by and about the plan they're covered by. So this would include information about the payer that would also obviously be of necessity for the provider to know, but also what their plan information is so that it could be used at later points in the process. So piggybacking off of that, the patient benefits coverage data class would be that data class surrounding the information for a patient and what their coverage is under the plan that was obtained in the previous data class. So this would be, in terms of the X12 context, this would be the kind of information, for example, that we would expect to see in the 270-271 transactions. So specific to an encounter, but information about a patient's benefit coverage. We had some discussion during the last task force meeting about the patient-generated data class. So we've got some comments in here about how this might potentially be leveraged in the future if some standards can be developed around it and incorporated into the prior auth workflow. So I know there were examples thrown around in the past by members of the task force about feedback that a patient may have on a piece of DME in the context of the wheelchair example that we discussed. For instance, about how that wheelchair may fit and different modifications that may need to take place after the initial fitment occurs. One of the other examples that was thrown out, so it's included here in the interest of comprehensiveness, is information from a patient about their, from an employer that may contribute to the justification for a particular prior auth. Any questions about that initial stuff, the next four data classes all kind of piggyback off of each other, so I can talk about those as a group, but any questions
the initial four? If you can take a break, Alexis Snyder has a question.
Yep.
Hi, in reference to the definition under the patient benefits, the patient-generated, area, I think the conversation wasn't about information that an employer would provide for further justification. I think we had one sample in the example from somebody in the beginning about employer information, but our conversation was largely about patient themselves or patient caregivers' input about why, justification for the equipment that may not be seen or in the written information from a provider. So more of an extension from the patient.
Got it. So is that a proposal to strike this last example then?
It's to modify it. So it should be where it says employer information required.
Right. I think what we were talking about there, the example given, Alexis, was if because of an employment situation, a member or patient needs specific equipment or attachments to their durable equipment in order to perform the duties of their job. So there
right.
may
no,
be...
I understand yeah. that. I know Carolyn had brought that up way back in our very first meeting. I'm saying in addition to that, that our discussion last week or perhaps the week before was about patient/caregiver-generated information, about more of a this is why I really need this information.
So
like a personal statement
are you saying,
from a patient or caregiver.
Gotcha. Okay. So still about how it may be required, you know, for the performance of a job duty, but you're just emphasizing that the origin of the information is the patient.
Regardless of employment, even if we're talking about pediatrics, that's why I keep saying patient and caregiver input. So it would be like a third bullet or an end. It's not just about employer information. It's about finding a place for a personal statement from either patient or caregiver on the need.
Okay.
Gotcha.
I was misunderstanding you also because I thought the first statement that was there, that's what we were talking about. And Josh, all of a sudden it went away.
Oh, it's back.
Now it's back.
Yeah, no, the first statement is just about fit. That's about after the fact. We're talking about before for the prior authorization to get the coverage, to get the equipment to begin with.
Gotcha.
I mean, I would just further offer, I mean, you can leave it, but I think I've mentioned this in the past, maybe in the smaller group, but as far as fit, I mean, that's automatically in that process already. When a DME provider delivers equipment, the patient needs to sign off and accept and answer an entire list of pieces about fit and match, et cetera. So, I mean, there's already process for that. And if you don't sign it, it gets rejected and it starts all over again.
So are you happy with the way he modified it now?
Let's make it bigger again. Yeah, that's fine. The last piece I was just saying is that the fitment, whether you want to keep it or not, is already a part of the process. It's the standard for
yeah.
DME.
Okay. Any other questions or comments before Josh moves on? All right, go ahead, Josh.
All right, thanks. The next five data classes are all essentially specific to the life cycle of a particular prior authorization request. So the initial data class is, we're calling it the PA request data class. So this would be information that the provider submits to the payer specific to the treatment, procedure, service, or product for which prior auth is actually being requested. And this would contain information about the requester, specialty, those kinds of considerations, as well as the site of service, which I think are all things that have been brought up by task force members to date. The PA response data class is all around really coverage rules specific to that request. So this is intended to address the notion that the sooner in the process a provider knows what the rules are for coverage for a particular prior authorization, the sooner they can begin collecting all that information and making it available to the payer for review and approval. The PA justification data class would then be more of the response to that response data class, sharing all the documentation that would or information that would be needed to actually process the request on the payer end. So this would include things like the medical necessity documentation we've discussed at length in the past, any kind of history of past treatments that may be necessary, as well as in clinical diagnoses that might be used to justify the request. Then the follow-up data class is really reserved for those instances when the information submitted with a justification may not be comprehensive enough to actually approve the request initially. So the notion here is that rather than denying the request, creating a way for that conversation to continue electronically so that the provider could then have an opportunity to add to the information that was requested to ensure that an accurate depiction of the patient's status has been submitted and shared with the payer, that it can be reviewed for approval. And then lastly, in this section, the PA decision data class is really designed around that final approval or denial event. So I think the emphasis here has just been on making sure that whatever kind of code is returned to signify an approval or a denial is concrete enough that it can then be later used in the billing process. So in the event of an approval, the idea would be that the approval received as part of this process would be sufficient in terms of billing so that ultimately the billing process can be completed swiftly. In the event of a denial, however, the emphasis is on just making sure that there's sufficient information being transacted between the provider and payer so that the provider can better know the reason for the denial so that the provider can learn from that in the future and ensure that in similar situations, the same kind of denial doesn't happen in the future if it can be prevented. So those are the five data classes that I would consider to be all kind of tied to that feedback loop around the prior auth request itself. So I'll pause there and see if there are any questions or comments specific to those.
We do see one question, Alexis Snyder.
Hi, I would add to the PA decision box information provided to the provider and transparent to the patient, perhaps something with that wording, because you either get a letter with an acceptance or denial in the mail from the payer, and it doesn't always there or on an EOB have reasoning either. And you really need that to start an appeal process on that side as well.
Call out, I'm adding that exact verbiage in here. Any concerns from anyone else about amending this description?
Yeah, hey, Josh. Information from Georges.
Yeah.
I'm having trouble with the hand on the computer, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Who was that?
Jim Georges.
Jim.
Hey, One question for the group is on that piece about, I view it like two sides of a coin. On the front end, the provider is having enough transparent insight into what the rules are, not just the data needed, but what the rules are. And then on the back side, when there's a denial, enough granularity about why. And I'm just curious if this task force can we define what level of granularity? Because sometimes,
yeah,
you know, not covered or didn't meet, there's a certain level of granularity that if we don't address it, it'll end up being too abstract and not benefit the provider as much.
I think you hit a really good point because in the last meeting also, we talked about adding the PA rules to this data grid. And I don't think we did that yet, Josh. So can you add a column for PA rules? And then we would need to add an item for it.
Is that a column or is that a row?
I mean, it's a row. We need to add a row.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Yeah. And we did talk about that last week also, was adding a row for PA rules.
Yeah, I agree. I was trying to address that here in the PA response category, and maybe it's just a naming convention thing that's making this, it's kind of burying it. But I think the idea here was after the initial request is submitted by the provider, the immediate response from the payer would be information about the coverage rules. Is that the kind of rules we're talking about?
Yeah, but I do think it needs to be its own row. It should be its own row.
Yeah, it should be overt because it is a very different kind of data, and there may be some reason some constituents may choose not to get granular. And so I think we talked about last time calling it.
And we even talked about adding two rows, one for PA rules and one for PA data requirements is the notes that I had. Because we said they could
be
different. It may be that if we can't get agreement or collaboration on the rules, then at least we could maybe on the data requirements. And that also came up in the CAQH meeting last week as well.
And I think, too, that there's probably two rows under the response. There's one that's more the 278, the sort of denied, et cetera. But then there's another layer of detail about, exposing to the patient, thank you, Alexis, as well as the providers, what rule was violated that actually led to the denial. And I mention that because it's not just so that providers can get trickier about actually getting the approvals, although if it's for the patient's benefit, that would be appropriate, but also so that providers can learn when it's not appropriate and not even initiate and waste everybody's effort. The more transparency, the less of that occurs as well. And so, therefore, I think both on the front end, there's two rows, and on the back end, there's denial, yes or no, versus appropriate level of detail.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Can I just take a check? Alex, we had said at 4, we were going to pivot to the timeline discussion. It's 4 now, and we're not yet done with this discussion.
I agree with you. Keep going on this, especially because I think there's also been there's at least one hand up, and I'm debating whether I'm putting my hand up or not. I think you keep going, and then how about we make sure that in about 10 minutes, or actually within 15 minutes, we'll make sure to at least queue people up for public comment.
Okay, and then if we have to diary over the timeline discussion, we can do that to next time if we don't have time to get through it today. Okay, then why don't we move to Jocelyn? Jocelyn had her hand up, and then we can come back to you, Alex.
Oh, sure, I'll put my hand up.
Okay, so I think this is a really important point, and I think calling these out as separate lines I think is really important. And I'll tell a little bit of an anecdotal story. When I worked for Navinet, we would go out as product managers into the field and do research with providers that were really, I would say, sort of people that had done that manual automation of prior auth, right, had created centers of excellence around getting PA done. And inevitably, we would hear that they would literally print screen the affirmation that the prior auth had been approved, and they would store it in their practice management system, the actual screenshot itself, because they viewed Navinet at the time as the source of truth, that they could use that when their claim was later denied. And I think what's important here is that things happen along the way between when you actually proposed and got approval on a particular event or activity for a patient, and subtle changes that happen between then and when the claim gets submitted in the future. And I feel like there needs to be more connectedness so that the provider team or whoever's providing the service or the patient is alerted to one of those subtle changes that's going to trigger either the need to re-auth or trigger the potential for denial when somebody's submitting the claim. So I think this ability of being able to expose the rules as things that you can interact with and understand, I think will make that easier. I think that to me, when I look at sort of the challenge, it's that, There's so much variation between what I'm doing today on, you know, May 26th and what will happen when I show up for my surgery on July 27th, that inadvertently creates additional weight. And because these processes are really opaque today, it stops the ability for people to warn each other, right, that they've done something that could trigger a denial or no payment. So I guess that's the first part. And I think in the second part, this idea of being able to say that exposing the rules needs to happen up front, because I do think that there is the what did I submit and what did I get back, the PA request and the PA response, that totally makes sense. But I think ahead of that, it's what is that that you're doing to make the rules and the coverage transparent. And I'm not sure whether or not rules and coverage need to be completely separate, but I do like the idea of breaking rules out as a separate category.
Yeah, I agree. And Josh, what I'll do is after today's meeting, I'll go in and expand out those rows for cover and add a definition for the PA rules and the PA data requirements. But I do think they should be separate. All right, Alex,
excellent.
Do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I guess I just, I've been thinking about this rules and data requirements and then the specificity of the response that gives clarity to the recipient. And I want to make sure, since I can't manipulate the spreadsheet at the moment, I'm kind of curious, like, where are we handling the remark codes? You know, I know we had a discussion on it last week, and shout out to Mel, who made me aware that if it's CARC and MARC cards we're using, that Medicare created additional codes to provide greater specificity around prior auth sort of responses. And so I know this has been an ongoing theme. So I just wanted to ask Josh if we had it sort of, if the specificity of the response code sets is captured in here as something we're going to get at and look at more specifically.
Yeah, good question. I guess I would pose that to the group to see if what we've kind of sketched out here is comprehensive enough. But I think in my mind, the information that you're pointing to about the remark codes and things would be things we're looking at in this ultimate decision bucket, unless I'm misinterpreting what you're saying. But I'm thinking this is where we're ultimately deriving whether there is an approval or a denial, and if there's a denial, what the reasons behind that denial are in the right level of specificity.
It looks like it could resonate, but it has to be more than just a denial. It has to do with append as well.
Okay, good point.
Yeah, that's a really good
Thank
point.
You.
All right, Jim has his hand up, and then Alexis. Yeah. So Jim, go first.
Yeah, I just wanted to be clear that it's one thing to state that the rules need to be exposed, but it's another to have it be in the workflow. And I'm wondering if we need to call something out. The reason I say that is I know for medical services, if you ask the people at HCA who work those services, they will go to, you know, a several hundred page PDF where you can, if you want to, go look up what the rules are for any particular situation. But, you know, multiply that by the number of payers and multiply that by the variations with which they're updated. Some are every 6 months, some more frequent, some less. It becomes effectively unusable. So is there some, maybe this is in the principles, I don't know if we captured it in the principles document, but is there some, work information flow in the workflow principle we need to call out, so we don't end up with giant tomes of information no one accesses that actually click box for requirement?
So that gets to the point that was made previously also about adding burden, right, where it's great to say have predefined rules and data requirements. But again, if you've got hundreds of pages for, you know, multiple payers, how does anyone manage that? So I think that is a balance that we need to speak to in our recommendations related to, you know, how this could possibly be done without adding additional burden. And maybe there is a way to, you know, link to some open, and I'm not going to say open source, but open capability within the EMR system that would allow you to access, you know, a payer-populated rules engine or something. I don't know. But I don't want to design a solution. But at the end of the day, it might require something like that to be able to provide that in a real-time way, which otherwise would result in a lot of burden. So something we need to talk about as maybe an example.
Yeah, because right now also, you know, every payer has their own portal. If you'll just sign on, you'll get everything
yeah.
you need. And that just does not work.
Right. And so, again, you're still talking about multiple portals. And I know even, you know, our own portal, it's not going to give you an online rules engine that's going to allow you within a few seconds to know what information requirements are there and what the rules are. You know, nobody has that right now. So, but that's a good point to note, and that's something we have to speak to in our final paper, like what really is reasonable on that item. All right, Alexis?
It goes back to the specificity of the and the transparency of why something was denied. So I just wanted to add that I think it also goes beyond just a code reason for denial, because quite often it has been my experience that denial code will be a miscellaneous, like a 999 miscellaneous code, which means nothing. And, you know, again, just needing that information so that folks know what is missing and why it was denied and how to proceed to either fix it or appeal it. So not just a recommendation that the code comes along with it, but a clear code, not a miscellaneous code.
Yeah, I think that's a fair request and something we definitely should, you know, talk about in, again, our final recommendations. All right, and we'll capture that as part of the description around reasons for denial or PENS, because it could be for either or. All right, Jocelyn?
I think that the point around not increasing additional burden, I think, is incredibly important here, because I think that there's a step between making data known and aware and potentially automating. So I think from a principal's perspective, I think it's really important that we acknowledge that when work needs to be done, that there is the ability to not stop somebody in workflow from doing what they need to do, to turf work off. Like, I think it's that workflow is king here in all of the conversations that we're having. And I don't know at what level we'll go through describing that, but I can tell you from having rolled out EPA for pharmacy with the assumption that docs, by some, that docs were going to stop and do a PA while they were sitting in a room with a patient, was a non-starter and led to early failures of adoption. And recognizing that there were other parties doing that work, while not a perfect solution, have allowed adoption to happen to remove burden from that workflow. But the premise that we're going to put one more thing in front of the doc to have to do while they've got a patient in front of them, I think we should have watchword out about that.
Can I
yeah.
suggest some wording even for the principles? There's an informatics principle that really is what we're trying to get at here, and that is workflow-friendly information presentation, or this concept of an information flow that is built around a workflow is something we should consider, because it's an established principle, and it will avoid people clicking the box but it not being workflow friendly. That might be good for the principle.
That's a good point, and I made a note of
it. I'm capturing it.
Yeah, really good point. Jocelyn, did you have another one? All right. I think we're ready to move on, Jim, and we have a couple of minutes before we have to take public comment.
All right. So a couple last things to hit on. So a new data class, I think, technically to this table is this one we've labeled as service completion, which is really just intended to take into account that ultimately the goal of a prior auth follows all the way through to actual payment of a claim. I don't know that that's something we've specifically discussed as a broader group up to this point, but that's something that as a subgroup we felt like we wanted to reflect on the table here and make sure we are not omitting the fact that after a prior auth is actually processed, that ultimately there's, you know, another process that kicks off and there may need to be some interplay between the PA request and approval itself and then ultimately payment. And then lastly, there's kind of this catch-all metadata class that we've discussed in the past, which for the most part centers around information that systems need to be able to interoperate with other systems, as well as the notion I think Arian brought up first, maybe about the state machine and just being able to make information about the status of a PA request face up for the different constituents, payers, providers, patients throughout the life cycle of a PA request. Any questions or comments on those two before I hop back up to patient identity for a quick moment?
I'm not
yeah,
seeing
Andy, can
any
I comment about?
Yeah, I'm not
having trouble with my web. But
go ahead.
Can I make a quick comment? It's Jim Jurgis. You know, one of the things we talk about with the state machine, and I think, Alex, you may have been commenting about, is the situation changing as time goes on. So one of the things we've experienced is if there's an automated system that once the data is available just automatically sends it to the insurance company and then denial occurs, sometimes there's a timing issue where information that's not yet available is pending or is about to be ordered the next day. And then there ends up being a denial that's premature that leads to a lot of extra work. So I don't know if it's part of the state machine, but I think there needs to be the concept of time before conclusions are drawn that needs to be addressed, because first attempts at automation led to some premature denials because of that. I don't know where if that's part of the state machine or part of the rules.
Yeah, I think my two cents is that it may end up a little bit of both, but I'm curious. I can't recall off the top of my head, Alex, but I think you were about to chime in. There may be something valid here for the guiding principles.
Yeah, I was exactly where I was going, Josh. I was thinking about this timing aspect, and I think you're calling it a state machine. Like there things are highly fluid, and things can happen just in time or can happen too quickly that they're missing a piece and that things have to be redone. And so there's a complexity from the timing aspects that we maybe need to consider. So I'm adding this along with the workflow friendly concept to the document so that we can talk about it in the small working group.
Yeah, I like that. All right, anyone else with any final questions or comments before we move on to public comment? I think we can go ahead and put up the public comment on a slide. I don't see anybody's hands raised. Thank you so much, Josh, for doing all this work and presenting, and Jim and the others that have been involved in the data classes work group. I will go in and add those definitions to the things that we talked about today, so we'll at least have those to share for next time.
Okay, great. Like, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, like, Alex and Sherilyn. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say go ahead with public comment.
Okay, yeah, this is Michael. Thank you, guys. And operator, if we could please open the line for public comment.
Yes. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 to remove your comment from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we pull for comments. There are no comments at this time.
All right, wonderful. So, do we want to move now, Alex, into the discussion about the our timeline, and then we can check back the public comments?
I love that idea. Do you want to kick us off on the schedule?
Sure.
You and I didn't have a chance to really talk about the next couple of slides and how we were going to cover it.
No worries.
Go for it.
All right. Michael, can you put back up the PowerPoint? We're going to go, yeah. The next steps, just so that you're aware, for the full high-tech committee review, we did do our update in May. We have no planned actions for June. We were planning on presenting a draft of our comments and recommendations to the September 9th meeting. And what that means for us is that we will have to have a really good working draft by the end of July and have ample enough weeks to review that written draft multiple times before it actually goes to HITECH on the 9th. What typically will happen is on the 9th, HITECH will have a lot of questions and recommendations. We'll have a good amount of time during the meeting to review our recommendations. Most likely what will happen is there'll be a PowerPoint as well as a written paper. There'll be comments and questions that will come back to both of those. We'll have to rewrite those and update those, and then we re-present back in the October timeframe, allowing the fact that there are going to be revisions. The hope is that that would be the finalization. If we can't finalize it in that October meeting, then we would continue on for one more month with the final adoption, hopefully, happening for November 10th. And what happens is the HITECH does have to vote to accept the recommendations and the proposals that we make in our white paper. And so typically the PowerPoint will outline what is being recommended in the white paper, and then the HITECH members typically will be asked to read and review both and provide comments on a detailed level for both.
If I can add, I want to add to what Cheryl just said in that excellent overview of the HITECH schedule, and to add some commentary that as we were working offline on our scheduling, we realized that that HITECH takes a hiatus, and that we had to adjust a bit of our schedule to sync with their schedule. The bonus part of that is it maybe gave us like two more weeks of work time, which I think is a welcome addition. And so I think take questions as you were going to do on this slide, and that if they're not on this high-level slide, then maybe we want to go to slide 10 and walk through what we think that means to us at a little bit more of a discrete level.
Right. I don't see anyone with their hand raised at this point, but feel free to raise your hands as you need to. And then, so what does that mean for this group? Again, it means for this group that we will have the updates as we did today. Next week, we are expecting to have some additional presentations. The presentation from CMS on the document retrieval that we wanted to review, which is one of the DaVinci use cases that actually uses a couple of DaVinci APIs. And then we had a potential other presentation that would occur which we'll announce as soon as we have it finalized, and then moving over, and then we'll also review the adjustments that we made to the definitions for the data classes if we have time, based on what we talked about today. Then moving over to June 9th, we would go, at hopefully at that meeting, be able to look at the process map that another small group is working on, and then the privacy and security deep dive where the ideal state and goals group has pivoted to. So we would have updates of those coming in the June timeframe. And then on about sometime in the middle of June timeframe, we need to start drafting what our final paper is going to look like so that we have the ability for different stakeholders on this work group to sort of split up, divide and conquer, if you will, take a topic, and then actually start exploding out our recommendations and our discussion items that we want to include in that paper. And just to provide a better picture, that paper usually talks about a current state, and then it will talk about our guiding principles and ideal state, and then it will talk about our recommendations and enumerate those one after the other with backup information relative to how and why, and then it will talk about the history of the work task force, the different groups that came to speak, all of the things we did to sort of level set prior to us actually having the recommendations with the final paper. So we need to start formulating that. The hope that Alex and I both had was that we could actually start making assignments in the June timeframe so that pretty much all of to the middle of the end of July is going to be reviewing different groups of pieces of that document as we start putting it together and it starts formulating a better picture in your mind so you know what it's going to entail, who's responsible for doing what, and how we're going to review that over the July and August timeframe, knowing that we're going to be losing people here and there for vacations and other things, even with the pandemic that we're dealing with. The hope is that we will have all of our comments on data classes, ideal state, and then abstracting up from there to the intersection of clinical administrative data by the end of June, and again, use all of July and August to iterate the paper, have our full review and discussion of the initial draft by the beginning of August, as I mentioned before. So we'll have a few weeks to iterate that, revise it before it actually goes to high tech for the September 9th meeting. And we would like to have it prepared at least a week in advance of that meeting, if possible, to give people time to review it and make comments so that in the meeting, they're actually able to provide some substantive, input. And then again, the final recommendations in October. So Alex, do you wanna expound on what I just talked about?
I think you gave a really great overview, and I'm so appreciative of your experience with the high-tech formal reports. We will be leveraging a template, so we'll start to have a framework of where we started and where we need to get to with that template and start to help build out some assignments. We have been getting notable success with these small working groups and some offline efforts, so I think that the breaking us into portions of, or the task force into portions of work teams will help us with really drafting the various sections and then being able to hopefully get some ONC support to just smooth it all out across our work efforts would be helpful. One of the things I want to note is that we are looking for a couple of presentations in the middle part of June just to help us with pivoting not only finishing up prior authorization, but pivoting to the larger conversation, because we are going to need to do a pretty robust effort of extracting up from prior authorization to the larger convergence issues. So that effort may then inform some agendas for the actual task force meeting so we can kick some tires and get general direction to help the groups. That said, I think we're about out of time. There we go.
Yeah, let me just check back. Yeah. Did we, operator, did we get any anyone else for public comment or no?
No, or there are no comments.
Okay, perfect. All right, so we have one final slide, which is this slide for next steps. So please, if you have additional input or updates for the workbook, please feel free to share them. We'd like to get that effort wrapped up. As we are starting the process models, it's going to be very important that we move forward in our conversation to start framing up the components of the paper. And then next week we have the CMS presentation and moving again from prior authorization to the broader discussion of integration with clinical administrative data and some of the recommendations that we have around that effort. And then longer term, which we already just talked about, but the recap here on this slide as well, there may be some additional industry presentations in order to provide that pivot for us. So any other questions or comments before we break? Seeing none, then I'm going to say thank you very much, and we hope you all have a wonderful week, and we really appreciate your efforts and commitments to this important topic.
Okay, thank you so much. Irene, with that, as you can see, the next meeting is next Tuesday, June 2nd. Thank you all for joining today. I hope you can join again in the future. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. Thank you all.
Thanks, all.
Thank you, Michael.